This is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Lay on the head on boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
A bit lower and faster here.
Ho ho ho! That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the lay line there.
Welcome back, podcast listeners. Thank you for joining us from wherever you are in the world. It is great to have you along for another deep dive into the wonderfully diverse world of sailboat racing. And I can promise you now, this month's edition is particularly special. I've done an awful lot of interviewing in my time as a broadcaster, not just on the podcast, but for a whole host of different programmes and channels. And in that time, I've talked through some remarkable stories. And my chat with this month's guest, it's right up there. It's no exaggeration to say our discussion this month is nothing less than sailing folklore. It's a remarkable story told in a very modest manner. Before we get going, just a quick thank you to everyone that got in touch after last month's podcast with Brian Thompson. Another popular edition, so thanks for getting in touch and letting us know your thoughts. Thanks too to all of you that took the time to head over to buymeacoffee.com to support the podcast. If you haven't done so already, it's very quick, very easy. buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast. Leave us a message and buy us a few coffees. If you've already done so this season, many, many thanks. If not, then wherever you are, help us keep the pod ad-free by showing your support. Thank you. Right, back to our guest this month. And if you're one of our younger podcast fans, it's quite possible you may not have heard the name Pete Goss. But throughout the 90s, he was becoming one of the world's best offshore sailors. From Cornwall in the southwest of the UK, Pete had his heart set on competing in the Vendée Globe. And by the third edition in 1996, he was on the start line with a brand new race boat. What followed was one of the most grueling editions the race had ever seen. And events in the Southern Ocean put Pete Goss on the front page of newspapers across the globe. It's a remarkable story. And as you'll hear later in this part, it's a story that almost 30 years on still stirs up emotion. I have to say, it's taken a while to sit down with Pete, but recording this edition of the podcast was an absolute privilege. He was incredibly generous with his time, and as you'll hear, he has some remarkable stories to tell. I hope you enjoy the time I spent with Pete Goss.
I can still remember now bailing that boat out 2 o'clock one morning and just thinking, this is amazing, this is what I want to do. 3M came in literally a couple of weeks before the start with £10,000 to put their logo on the mainsail. And that was when I knew I could do it. He lit up with this big smile and he just said, I've been waiting for you to come through that door for a number of years. And he sketched out this concept which absolutely mirrored what I had.
Pete Goss, you've been on our podcast wish list for quite some time, but you're always in the middle of something, normally cruising somewhere fabulous, but it's certainly worth the wait. Thank you so much for making it happen.
It's all right, it's a pleasure.
We've tracked you down in the wonderful Cornish countryside in the southwest corner of the UK in your gorgeous home, which you've built yourself, still building it, with your wife Tracy. I mean, it's off-grid, and with all the research I've done about you, I'm seeing a trend. You're not one for taking the easy option, it seems, Pete. You're always up for an adventure. I love that.
Yeah. Well, I feels odd being interviewed. I haven't been interviewed for so long. We're completely off-grid. And, you know, I was brought up on a farm, and so one has an empathy with nature and sailing. And I can remember when I was younger, we were trialling the first solar panels, this whole new wave. And so through all of the projects, have seen that technology develop and evolve. And Tracy and I, we've been living off-grid probably for 10 years now, maybe more, actually. So this project now is where all of that's been pull together. We're completely off grid, but not paying any price for it in the sense that, you know, we've got all the modern washing machines and tumblers and all the rest of it. So you can live like that. We have a borehole for our water. And so the whole place just runs from energy that falls out of the sky. And I think that's really cool. I think it's very exciting.
Well, it's great to see it. And it's a beautiful place in the planet. And as I said, Pete, it has been an intense week of research, all things Pete Goss. And this area of Cornwall seems an important thread throughout all your projects. Is that fair?
Yes, this is. Well, I've had a funny life in that my father was an agricultural consultant in tropical agriculture, so he used to go away for projects, generally 2 years. And generally back then, parents would send their kids off to boarding school, but we were really lucky. We're wonderful parents. It's the greatest lottery of life is your parents, isn't it? And they decided if they were going to have kids, they'd have them. And so my mum taught us, which is amazing, really. Four boys, all mad as fish, all different ages. And she taught us on her own. We had a very regimented school program. So you might be doing a chemistry experiment. I would be doing an English dictation, but pressing pause on a tape recorder, which she'd done the night before, and someone else would be doing with art, and then she would be physically teaching the fourth one. And she took, certainly, my older brother beyond O-level. I was up to just about O-level. And we travelled all around the world, living out in the bush and the wilds, but our roots were always in Cornwall, on this Rain Peninsula. And so I've always come back here. It's always where I come back to, and I love to go away, but it's good to have roots somewhere. So this is, I mean, we planted all these trees, or my mum and dad did. So this is just part of my life.
What was that young boy like?
Well, I was always in trouble. I was a naughty boy, I think. I think I was a bit of a handful. But I don't know. I was lucky, you know, saw a lot of life and, you know, quite an adventurous life. I mean, when we were in Aden, we would fly in on a Dakota onto the beach. And then I remember it was wild. I remember I had a pet goat and our transport was a mineproof Jeep with a machine gun. And we had bullet holes up the bedroom wall and guards around and once a month, we used to light car tyres and the Dakota would come in with food. And I can remember Dad sitting on Dad's knee with an Aldous lamp signalling the ships going up and down the Red Sea and effectively building up a relationship with the captains, because we had a Shearwater catamaran. I don't know if you remember them, hidden in a wadi. So if we were overrun, we would sneak down, get on the Shearwater, sail out. And we would need to get on a ship. So he was building a relationship with them. So always kind of had an adventurous life and was driving Jeeps in the bush from the moment we could reach the pedals and things. So very, very, very lucky in that sense. And I mean, we lived in my older brother was born in Nigeria and we lived in Aden, Pakistan, Australia, Saudi Arabia, Uruguay. So it was great to grow up properly within all of these different cultures and things. So we were lucky, terribly lucky. And then only managed 2 years at school. I couldn't stand it. It was a square peg in a round hole. And in a funny way, looking back, we had seen a little bit too much life. And I was never academic, so I left at 16 and went to the University of Life rather than the University of Knowledge, which suited me. So it's, you know, different people suit different places. And
one good thing did come out of school, though. You met your wife, Tracy, who is also a common thread throughout all your crazy adventures. I mean, you were so young, weren't you? Tracy was 13
yeah,
and 14. You were 14.
Yeah. We've known each other for a very, very long time. Tracy doesn't believe me. I always said I did. I knew I'd marry her, but it took till It was funny. I was in the Royal Marines then and come home on leave and was getting on the Torpoint ferry to get the train back to Scotland very early in the morning. It was about 6 o'clock or something. And there was Tracy on the same bus. And that was where we started properly, in a sense, our relationship. But yeah. So we go back a long way. Yeah.
She also must have a pretty adventurous nature.
She does. She's very forgiving, and she's we life's for living, isn't it? You know, and if you want to go and live, you've got to commit to things and take risks and gamble and work hard and all the things that we all know, and we make a really good team.
Well, Pete, as you said, you left school when you were 16 years old. And one of your first jobs was as the nipper, the kid on a tugboat, working out of Plymouth. And that's got to have been a tough job.
No, I mean, I loved it. It was fantastic. I mean, I was used to hard work. I was brought up on a farm. And so, I mean, one of the great things about a farm is it gives you a work ethic. You know, you get up, you work hard, you see a job, you do it, and you get on. So, but I'd always loved the water. I don't know, I've always had an affinity with the water. And to get on a professional tug was incredible, because I sailed a lot. You know, I was dinghy sailing. I was only one day I didn't sail, which was a Monday. So Tuesday was dinghy sailing, Wednesday was cruiser racing, Thursday was dinghy sailing. Friday we started a cross-channel race and come back on a Sunday. And Monday was the only day I didn't sail. So water was very much a part of our lives. But then I used to work on these tugs. Yeah, they were rough, hard, but good, honest people. Yeah, I learnt to drink when I was 16 on the tugs. It was terrible, really, but... Yeah, it was a wonderful job, and there was a salvage tug. I worked on various tugs, so mooring and salvage, laid all the moorings for HMS Ark Royal, the aircraft carrier, with, you know, chain links, you're thousands of tons of chain you're pulling around, and then worked on the Robus, which was a salvage tug, and did various salvage jobs, which were from burning gas tankers in Torbay to, and that was a really interesting job. Quite dangerous to the Fastnet 79 was out on that. And so kind of that was quite a sobering experience. And then, you know, knocked some of the naivety out of it and started to really respect the sea and be appreciative of the risks that we face. But it was, I love innovation and technology and trying to address them. But it was a great job.
As you said, you were involved in the 1979 Fastnet race disaster, part of the rescue effort. You were just a kid, a teenager. I mean, what memories do you have of that? And, you know, you were a keen sailor at the time. How did that affect you?
Well, we missed the worst of the storm. So it was funny. My dad was a brilliant amateur forecaster, and he phoned up that night and said, "Pete, don't go out tonight. You're going to be called out." And no one predicted this at all. And so I didn't go out. And sure enough, the beepers went off and was rushed in. And he was amazing. All the farmers around here would phone up Dad to see should we cut the hay. So really picked up the aftermath, very big swell, but basically the detritus of the fleet. So, you know, picking up abandoned boats and seeing, I remember there was one boat, someone had died on it, but down below, I mean, there was vomit all over the thing. There was gear everywhere. Batteries had broken loose. And, you know, a lot came from that Fastnet race, you know, with rudders, training, crew didn't know each other. Lead acid batteries thrown around the boat, mixing with salt water to make chlorine gas. You know, it was pretty sobering to go down and see the remnants of what had gone on in that storm. I mean, there was other things we were involved in, but I certainly learnt to respect the sea, very much so. Not frightened of it. I mean, I love it, but respect it and treat it with respect and you'll be fine.
And people on our podcast find professional sailing from all sorts of circuitous routes. For some, it seems as if it's perhaps their destiny, and for others, it almost happens by accident. I mean, what about you, Pete? You've been in the Royal Marines, you joined the Royal Marines. I mean, how much did that prepare you for a life at sea?
Well, I don't, you know, I'm not a professional. I like I say, I don't have a career. I have a series of daft ideas, and I'll come up with a daft idea and just take it from this. And they come to me on a train, I've no idea why, and take it from a little idea, hopefully through to conclusion. Most of it's in sailing, but I've dabbled in other areas. I mean, my lucky break came in the Marines, and what had happened was the Royal Navy had a load of sail training yachts, which are quite tired and old, needed to replace them, put them on the market, couldn't sell the last one, which they donated to the Royal Marines, fell under the responsibility of my commanding officer, all by chance, and he felt it ought to do something and asked, you know, myself and a good friend, Chris Johnson, would we care to do the two-handed transatlantic race, which kind of wasn't a request, but, you know, it was just landed in our laps.
In the boat that no one wanted.
Yeah, yeah. And well, that was interesting. We gave her a refit and had it surveyed. It had a Lloyd's A1 certificate. So on the face of it, this was a really good, safe boat. We sailed across the Atlantic. We followed the vapor trails. It was amazing, really. And it started breaking up. We'd had a bad storm and we bailed it out for 15 days. It was an amazing experience. It was the first time I'd done an ocean race. Because it's funny, people always ask about getting into this. And I just, you know, I can remember dinghy sailing. And my mum and dad, when I think back now, when I was about 10, my older brother would have been 12. And we used to pack up a mirror dinghy and bugger off for a long weekend, no phones or anything, and they just let us go. They taught us safety, they had faith in us. And, you know, so you go and do things like that. And then I remember my first channel crossing was amazing. You know, Dad had put me in charge of the victuals and we lost sight of land and we ended up in a foreign country and had croissants and things. And if you love looking over that horizon into the newer territory, then the next thing is you do more expansive sailing, perhaps a fast net race, and then you want to cross an ocean, and if you cross an ocean then you want to go around the world, and so you're kind of naturally led from one thing to the next. And if you're lucky and you've had a lot of help and support and work hard, then, you know, eventually you'll end up doing some of the big ocean races. But that first two-handed transatlantic was where I kind of, that was where I found what I wanted to do. And I can still remember now bailing that boat out 2 o'clock one morning and just thinking, God knows why, but this is amazing. This is what I want to do. And I made a commitment just quietly and in a commitment to do a single-handed round-the-world yacht race. And then from that moment on, that was my everything I did was towards that. But that first 200 race was the catalyst, and we made a lot of mistakes, but the key is, you know, not crying over the mistakes but celebrating the lessons and you know, learned things like that boat was the Lloyd's A1 and it fell apart around us. We bailed it out. So I've always had a policy since then of never, particularly the Southern Ocean, is you never go down there unless we've designed the boat ourselves, built the boat ourselves, and, you know, we know there isn't a Friday afternoon or a Monday morning job. And and I love making things, designing things. And
well, you had the dream and the ambition, but by now it was the early 90s. You had a young family. You had little choice now but to find a way to earn a living. And just at that time, Che Blyth had announced the British Steel Challenge, which would later become the BT Challenge, a race around the world the wrong way with amateur sailors. I mean, the first of, first of a lot of those races. And here you were in your early 20s looking for a job. What happened there?
Well, it was thrilling. I mean, this amazing. I mean, it was so audacious, but it was also chimed with everything I believe, because I'd I was very lucky in the Marines. I ended up sailing full-time in the sailing centre. So I'd spent a lot of time training people to sail. And the best way to learn is to teach. And so I had that side. I had a thirst for adventure. And I love helping people fulfil their dreams and sort of getting them on their feet. And then I had the ocean racing stuff. And it was thrilling. And anyway, Che advertised for a training skipper, and I went for an interview and got on really well. He said he would love me to have the job, but I was too young. And it was really difficult because you can address everything by your age. But he said, I'd like to keep in touch, and maybe you could do some corporate hospitality. I didn't even know what that was. I had no idea. And anyway, he'd had an older skipper come on, and that hadn't worked out, and I did some corporate hospitality. And so he asked, would I perhaps be a stand-in skipper while he found another one? So I would take anything that was on offer, and I went up and just took to it like duck to water, and he quickly decided, well, you can, it's your baby and away you go. And it was just fantastic. It was quite interesting that things like that had not been done before back then. This concept of taking, I mean, you go up mountains, you can do anything now, but all the experts said it was impossible. And I remember one boat show, it was a load of professional sailors. It put their nose out, and they were saying, you know, at least one boat would sink, 10 lives would be lost. And I remember one saying, if you want to make a load of money, buy some single tickets from Tasmania home and you'll flog them for thousands. And I just thought, bugger it, you've just got it all wrong. These people were amazing, you know. They ranged from 20 to 60, microsurgeon, bricklayer, baker, doctor, student. We had the whole gambit. They'd never sailed before. And I was just given this job to prepare them. And so it was very interesting as to how, what is one trying to achieve with the training program. And do you know, they were fantastic. They were fantastic. And it was the greatest reward, I think, for me, was to do that training. Yeah, yeah.
Well, by now, it's the mid-90s, isn't it? And your sights were firmly on the Vendée Globe. And we've talked a lot about the Vendée on this podcast, you know, non-stop, solo around the planet. By then, you know, two editions had taken place in 89 and 92. And the first one, almost exclusively French sailors, both of them with pretty much a 50% attrition rate. And in the 92 edition, tragically, two sailors were lost at sea. So the dangers were very clear. We talk a lot about the race to the start line in the Vendée. I mean, how tough was it in the mid-90s, a British sailor trying to raise the money for the campaign? How much did you risk to make the start line?
Well, there's two challenges. The first is to get to the start line, and then obviously the second is to get to the finish. And that second one's refreshingly simple and easy. You're just sailing around the world. It's what you love doing, and it's great. The first challenge, I think, is often the harder one, with all of the unknowns. And back then, sponsorship was difficult, you know. It was, and I didn't really, I was still new to business, so I had a lot of lessons to learn there. And I did, I'd realised that this would only happen if I went for it. And so Trace and I decided, right, well, we would go for this. I left the challenge business, Che's business, put myself on the streets to give it total focus. We scrabbled around, and I did. I'd hitch up to London. I'd sleep on Paddington Station and have a wash and a brush up in the public toilet and knock on doors and start this thing going. And I had a different, slightly different approach to sponsorship, I think, back then, which had evolved over time. I don't like the word sponsorship because it means a philanthropic gesture, and I'd rather it be a two-way street. So Again, these things evolve, but a hidden agenda would be that a sponsor should recoup their outlay and make a measurable return as a consequence of being part of the project, which is a very different approach.
I read your book and I read some real sponsorship horror stories.
Oh, God, you know, yeah.
And if we just sort of remember the time, before email, of course, you know, and you did a massive mail out in the search of help, and your book paints a pretty bleak picture of that process.
Well, sponsorship's a funny thing, because when you get a sponsor, when you look back at the journey to getting them, it's really simple and it just all clicked in place and away you go. The tricky thing is to turn over that stone. And the only way to do that is turn over thousands of stones. So I used to get the papers, I'd look through companies, see ones that were doing well. I'd go to, I'd phone them up, get them to send their annual report. I'd read up further, you'd get all the board. I'd go to the library, look in the who's who, find out who sailed. And then I printed off these standard sheets and I'd crunch them into files. But I had a light box and I'd use the annual report to colour in the logo with a pencil on the outline of the boat and send it off, and just loads of things. I'd just try anything. You know. And I'd sent 20,000 of those out, I think, from memory. But it requires commitment, absolute commitment. And we raised enough money to start building the boat. We got halfway through construction and just hit the buffers and learned about cash flow. We were so naive. And it was Tracy's idea. We decided to sell the family home to keep the project going. We had three young kids. And the moment we'd done that, that absolute commitment, it was like someone had bolted wheels on the project and it took off. And I think it really demonstrates that unless you personally are absolutely committed to something, then you can't expect anybody else to be. And it's a really important point. But yeah, it's tough getting to the start, particularly back then where there wasn't really much sponsorship in the UK. So we were learning. I'd just phone everybody up. Phone a marine photographer. When you scan a fleet, what boat do you take a picture of? And they all said the yellow boat. So Aquacorum was yellow. Everything we could do was any little nuance was lever it to get this boat.
Even though it was tough, you did manage to build a brand new boat. Not many first Vendée Globe sailors do that. Designed by Adrian Thompson. I mean, tell us about the boat. Tell us about the vision. I mean, it was ahead of its time in many ways, wasn't it?
Back then, there seemed to be this transition into the smaller, planing, lighter. And I just really seemed to me that the lighter and the simpler that was the way to go. And if you have one person on the boat, then... and you look at the project, then the weakest link is the person on the boat. And therefore, everything we do should be about enabling that limited resource. And I studied all of the previous races going right back. And it's obviously a race of attrition. So what are the things that go wrong? Let's address those. And really distilled it down to a sort of granular level and got involved with NASA on the first ever sleep deprivation program. So we knew we were making best use of that limited resource. And then I looked around all the designers, and the person who seemed to resonate with that was this designer, Adrian Thompson. And he had some amazing monohulls and multi-hulls. So I felt a complete fraud. You know, he was building Rothmans at the time and Thursday's Child. He was a real dude, but was just up the road in Totnes. And I got an appointment and I went in. He's a big man in physique and character. And so I kind of rather shyly explained this idea, and he lit up with this big smile, and he just said, "I've been waiting for you to come through that door for a number of years." And he sketched out this concept, which absolutely mirrored what I had, and we went from there. He's a brilliant man. Brilliant man, very humble, very clever. And so we started, a lot of work was on the hull form. It wasn't a scow bow, but it was pushing out that so that the boat would track very well. We couldn't see the point of a lovely lightweight structure and then shoving tons of water ballast in it. So went for the swing keel, which again was very new then, wasn't really being done, and it was going to be a disaster and the keel was going to fall off and all the rest of it. Built the boat. Chap Gary Venning built the boat. We borrowed a building to build the boat. I mean, we just cobbled it together. But it was always the boat comes first. You know, we won't cut corners. We want to have this. Really, it should have been 60 foot, just couldn't afford it. So back then, the limits were between 50 and 60 foot. So we just thought, well, we'll go for 50 foot. And this concept should get more out of a 50 foot than you would out of a 60. And off we went. Yeah, and so Aquacorum was born. And loads of funny stories building the boat and cobbling through, and went out on the radio. We needed, I think, 2 tons of lead, and all the locals came with fishing weights, diving belts. A local organ, church organ, had been broken up. Organ pipes are made of lead, which is weird, isn't it? So we melted all those down and.
I love that. I love that. Anyway, you won the first race. You got to the start, and you know, we've been to quite a few Vendée starts. It is incredible. But this was only the third running of the race. I mean, what was the start like? And what are those famous Vendée crowds there? How did you feel, one of the first British entries in the race?
Well, yeah. Well, I'd never been to a start, you know. And I'd never, ever had anything to do with France. I was just going to do the Vendée. And I kind of turned up, and in my mind would be like, you know, the start of the Ostart. And I was late because we didn't have engines back then and there was no wind. I was just drifting around and wasn't going to make the deadline, and no communications, desperately getting on the radio, which was brand new, and trying to get through to Portishead Radio to make a phone call. And anyway, we just made it and just turned up to this. It was unbelievable. Fireworks and lights, because we turned up that evening when they had the big launch of the race, and I don't speak French, didn't have a clue what was going on, but it was good fun. Got very drunk that night and met skippers and things, and then the next day they had us racing go-karts for some reason, I don't know why, but it was all good fun. But again, we had no money. I was sleeping on the sails down below, and we were cooking on a camping stove on the pontoon, and we still didn't have enough money to start the race. I only got 3M came in literally a couple of weeks before the start with £10,000 to put their logo on the mainsail. And that was when I knew I could do it, you know. So it was behind all this, it was huge pressure, really. But the start was amazing. I mean, it was absolutely unbelievable. And just, we got there and headed off, and it was fantastic. It was sick as a parrot that night. We had a big front come through the Bay of Biscay, and got stuck into trying to do this race. Yeah. And pretty untried boat, actually. I mean, I had problems and with some of the electronics. It's funny now, you know, watching the Vendée, and people will say they've there's a problem with some electronics. Well, my autopilot wouldn't even follow apparent wind. It was me. So I used to sit in the cockpit and dozing off and used to just, you know, plus or minus 5-10 degrees to play the boat. That was that was my autopilot. Couldn't afford weather forecasts. And fortunately, the week before the start, the race organisers said they'd give us 5 days. So every 5 days I had a forecast. And funny really, isn't it? It's very different now. It's amazing. But it's still got that same spirit, you know, slightly pioneering and, yeah.
I remember talking to Mishdez, the professor you know, a legend of the race, obviously won it a couple of times. And he says, the thing about the Vendée is you have to prepare for something to go wrong every day. And lots of things did go wrong. And pretty early on, even in the Bay of Biscay, the fleet started falling apart, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's a race of attrition, really. They all are. I can't remember now. It's so long ago. But that first night was pretty wild. Quite a few boats dropped out. But I mean, that happens even now with these big budget boats. But I had a really simple boat, and I was just going to finish the race. If I had to hand steer it, I'd hand steer it. It was just, I was going to do it. Simple. Is this critical point when you realise you've just lost control? And it's kind of quite sobering, and you, all you can do is react and hope that it holds together. The BT Inmarsat system was beeping an alarm, and I didn't really know what it was. I hadn't heard this particular one, and wedged myself under the chart table and called up the message, and it was a mayday. They came up on the VHF, and so I remember chatting to them, and I said, oh yeah, how many people are involved in the rescue? And he just said, it's you.
And Pete, I mean, you've achieved an awful lot in your lifetime. But what happened next is perhaps the thing you'll always be remembered for. It's something that transcends sailing, transcends sport. Headline news around the world. Just set events up for us. Christmas Day, heading into the Southern Ocean.
Yeah, well, it was quite an interesting, you know, it was south of Australia, deep in the Southern Ocean. The race had been a pretty tough old race. We'd had a few big storms come through. But for me, on Aquacorum, I'd kind of settled things. And because of cash flow, I hadn't had as much training as I wanted. But by then, it had all come together, and it felt fantastic. I'd got this, you know, world record for a 50-foot, 24-hour boat, and it just felt great. It was buzzing. But woke up Christmas morning, I think it was, it was beautiful, you know, clear sky, crisp, bit of frost on the deck, northerly 20-knot breeze. But what was intimidating was that the pressure just plummeted. Clearly there was a very, very bad storm coming in. And the waiting is the worst thing. It's worse than the dentist. You know, there's hurricane force winds coming in. There's nothing you can do about it. But of course, once you're in the storm, you're up to your ears in mud and bullets, and you're just dealing with it. And it's kind of a relief in a funny way. But this was a very vicious entity. And I think in a few hours, it went from a northerly 25 knot round to southwest 40, 50, 60, 70 knots. And then I can't remember. It was around there that the wind instruments blew off. So I don't know where it went from then. But it kept rising. But the problem was, with a very big northerly swell, and quickly a vicious southwesterly sea built up. And when the two meet, you know, you get this huge upsurge of water. And they're funny things, these big ocean races. There's always one bad storm, and you instinctively know it when you're in it. And once you're in it, you're very conscious that provided you can nurse your way through without major damage, then you're going to finish that race. And this, without question, was the big one for the Vendée. And it's only happened to me a couple of times when a storm reaches this critical point when you realise you've just lost control. And it's kind of quite sobering. And you, all you can do is react and hope that it holds together. Got knocked down quite a number of times, getting quite a lot of damage. Very high speeds, out of control. The autopilot couldn't really handle it. So it was a bit chaotic. Then these big knockdowns, and then nearly pitch poled. That was when it was starting to think, this isn't good, you know. So I can remember being thrown up against the generator and slammed up against it, looking out the back of the boat, but was looking up at the sky with you know, gallons of water pouring down, and knocked over again, getting damaged now, crawled on deck, did quick jury repair, and I remember stumbling down, and it just seemed to be the safest place to be, was because there was big waves sweeping the boat, and it was going dark down below with the depth of water we were going under, and came down to this just carnage, as foot of water slopping around, and tools and equipment, and food dripping off the ceiling or the deckhead. And I always remember the food and thinking, well, how did that get there? And but the BT Inmarsat system was beeping an alarm, and I didn't really know what it was. I hadn't heard this particular one, and wedged myself under the chart table and called up the message, and it was a mayday. And and people always ask, what did you think when you got the mayday? Well, I thought, shit. The timing couldn't be worse, and found a chart, put a position down, and it was a guy, Raphael Dinelli, who was 160 miles away, but dead upwind in hurricane force conditions. And so it was pretty sobering, really. And decided to turn round. And again, that was a decision, I think, laid down by a tradition of the sea. If someone's in trouble, then you help them. But it did seem it was, and I've been involved in a lot of rescues over my time, but that was the first time that I thought you had to think about the consequences, and you think about your boat and your family and your life and everything. And it just seemed to me that you'll eventually get to a clear and simple crossroads. You keep digging, and you either stand by your morals and principles, or you don't.
There was no choice.
Very simple, deep in the valley. So,
did you know Raphael?
No, I didn't. That was the funny thing. You see, Raphael was an illegal entrant. He shouldn't have been there, and so I had met him. So whenever I do these big ocean races, just before the boats leave, I run around the fleet and just shake all the skippers by the hand and be safe, you know, have a good trip. And because everyone at that start line effectively has the same aspiration, but they're not going to get it. Nobody knows what they're going to get. We knew statistically 50% of the fleet wouldn't make it. At least one life would be lost. So I kind of just like to wish him well, you know. And he had got to the start a few days before we were off. And I remember his boat was full of people. It was carnage, and leaning down through the hatch. And I could see him and caught his attention and just shook his hand. And that was the only contact I'd had with him, really. And and so, yeah, turned around and started this two-day flog back, and it was terrible, really, really. Yeah, I mean, the boat was knocked down every 20 minutes. It was just, I mean, to give a sense of it, the boat was shaken so violently the generator ripped off its mount, so that if you can imagine being able to go to a marina and pick up a boat and shake it till the engine tears off, that was what it was like, you know. It was 2 days, 48 hours, I think, and there was three clear parts. The first was just to survive the storm, and I reckon if we could survive the storm without major damage, then just that's worry about 160 miles, and if we can claw that back, then worry about trying to find him on the ground. So like everything in life, if you have a very big challenge, break it into manageable chunks and deal with them.
How did you find him? I mean, the Australian Navy were involved, weren't they? I mean, how did you manage to find him?
Well, that was a really difficult thing. Because back then, the transponders weren't sending out a signal. It was a passive signal, and as the satellites went over, they would triangulate and give you a position. So there was error in it. And of course, the further south you went, the greater the error, because you were lower on the horizon compared to the satellites. We didn't have the same number of satellites as we do now. And so I got to his position, I think it was midnight on the second night. And but because I remember what had happened was he'd been cartwheeled, boats upside down, he was trapped in it. eventually came up, right, the mast had been pile driving up through the deck, diesel tanks had ruptured, and so he ended up on a boat that was completely submerged. And his life raft got torn away by the ferocity of the conditions, and he basically watched his life just blow away like tumbleweed. I mean, it's an amazing story. I don't think he gets enough credit for the part that he played, just surviving. Yeah. So he survived all that night into the following day, and the Royal Australian Air Force came out. They dropped two life rafts with a tether between them that drift down to him. He pulled the nearest one in, found there was no food or water, jumped back in and on the boat and managed to get a little box of food. And then a big wave swept the boat and a bottle of champagne came to the surface. So he went in with that, untied the raft and scrabbled around to make sure everything was okay before he stood back up to bid his boat farewell, only to find that it had sunk. I mean, the story is amazing. Anyway, I met the pilot and the navigator a year later in the boat show at the Guinness stand, and from the air they saw this figure clamber into the raft, and then the boat just ghosted away and disappeared underneath it. So the story is amazing, but where am I going with this? You asked a question now. Finding him, wasn't it?
Yeah, how did you find
him? Well, what happened was then the Royal Australian Air Force came back out again. Oh, that's what I was going to say. So that plane that had dropped his raft carried down to me, and they came up on the VHF. And so I remember chatting to them, and I said, oh, yeah, how many people are involved? Because I was still like 70 miles away or whatever. How many people are involved in the rescue? And he just said, it's you.
Wow.
Sorry.
Raphael was in that life raft, wasn't he, for 48 hours?
Yeah. God, I don't know where that came from. So that was quite sobering, you know. So I got his position, but I couldn't find him because it would keep changing this position, and it might be only a quarter of a mile, but it just as well be 100 miles. A terrible night. Sorry.
It's all right. It's a big deal.
Well, it isn't. It is. God knows why I'm so emotional suddenly. I'm not normally. I think it's you. So, So I was searching an area. I couldn't find him. I climbed the mast. I'm letting flares off. I was anything. But I just couldn't find him until the Royal Australian Air Force came back out again. And they managed to get the two of us together. And so it was really a huge team effort to rescue this man. I mean, there's all sorts went on. I don't know if you're interested. Little backstories. You remember it's Christmas Day. Meteo France, they came in on their Christmas night. They were sending me forecasts. It was right on the transition, the overlap between the MRCC control areas. And so from getting the Mayday to getting to him, I'd transitioned into another area, but the SATCOM wouldn't talk to the Australian one. I just couldn't make it work. And so what did I do? I sent a message to Tracy to say, Trace, I need some help. And there's a brilliant guy called Clive Puttock who worked up at Portishead Radio. And so she phoned Clive because he helped her with our communications. He drove in and worked out and made an email of all the software changes I had to make, sent that out. So I could make those changes, which meant I could talk to Australia because the boat was called Aquacorum and it was a French race. They thought I was a Frenchman, so it was all in French. And so there's loads of things were going on. You know, I was just one of a huge team. So again, a little thing, they came in, they had 40 minutes on station because of the limits of the range, and in the end they flew over Aquacorum towards me in transit, and they flashed their landing lights when they were directly above him, and that was really what got us together.
The pictures are famous in the sailing world, taken by the Air Force,
Yeah.
What did you find when you got to them?
Well, that was the funny thing, because it was very clinical up till that point. It was just got to get there and really just that lifetime of experience, fall on that and see what can happen. So we didn't know, will it be an empty raft? Will there be a body in it? Will he be injured? I just had no idea. And I was incredibly close to him when we both popped up, because there were huge seas popped up on the top of the two waves, and there was this raft, this bright colour, and then I got closer to him and a little head popped up and I couldn't believe it. It was amazing. So I was down to the storm jib now and run the halyard back to the cockpit. I had I'd put lines between the guardrails all around the hull in, you know, big loops, just trying to think of everything that would help. I had a big line out the back with not loops on it, because I had no engine, you see, and it was a pretty lightweight, pretty lively little boat, you know. And it's still, you know, when it got to Force 8, it felt like a calm. It was lovely. So, but it just was perfect. Stopped the boat alongside, rolling violently, and I had a spare safety strop, which I'd already clipped to the deck on that side, ran up. And as the boat rolled, plunged into the raft, and I clipped it to his jacket, and I had him.
What a moment. How lucky was he, Pete, to be alive all that time in the lifeboat?
Yeah. Well, I don't know how he did it. He was a hell of a mess. Because I clipped it to his jacket, and then rolled, sort of disappeared out of the raft, and then rolled back in again and grabbed him, pulled him on deck. And he fell, he fell just flat on his face. And that's when I realised how ill he was, and rolled him over, and we had a little hug. And then suddenly it became very emotional. It just been a job up till that point. And I'll never forget his eyes. All I could see was this pair of eyes, and you can see into somebody's soul. So dragged him to the back of the boat, and I kept very close medical records. I had doctors at the other end of the SATCOM, and I think they reckon he had about 10 hours to live. He was real frightful state. The first layer of his eyes were pebble dashed off by the spray. He couldn't see very well. He was hypothermia, was definitely hypothermic, and he was as stiff as a board. And then it suddenly started to get quite funny, because I don't know if anybody's moved house recently, but I had a little hatch. I tried him head first. I tried him feet first. I couldn't get him down. So I actually was standing on him to bend him, and we got the giggles and got him down, and I put him in my best sleeping bag and thermals. I remember faxing back to the race HQ just to say, I've got him, he's alive, and can you tell his family? And went on deck and just had to get the boat going again, really, just gently going downwind with the storm jib, and then went back down below. And the funny thing was, I reckon I lost about a stone and a half in 48 hours. When I stripped off, I couldn't recognise my body, you know, and all I wanted was an hour's sleep. But of course, they get on a survivor's high and he's rabbiting away. I couldn't shut him up. And that was when we discovered, you know, he doesn't speak English and I don't speak French. And we built this great relationship, because it didn't finish with the rescue. It took 10 days to get to Tasmania to drop him off. And I had to give him muscle relaxants and I gave him physio had to lift him out of the bunk to the toilet, and I had to feed him every 4 hours. So I was nursing him, basically. But during that period with charades and, you know, pictures and things, we could eventually have a very deep conversation, and we're the best of friends. I was talking to him a couple of weeks ago, and you know, he's an amazing man. Within 5 days we were designing his next boat for the next Vendée. You know, it just hadn't put him off. And then there was funny things. You wouldn't believe it. It was a film. So after about 4 or 5 days, he indicated he wanted to send a message to Virginie. They had a daughter, Philippine, but they weren't married. And so I filled a kit bag with gear and suspended it from the deckhead, and I lifted him onto it and tied him to the chart table and put his fingers on the keypad and went on deck. I had a load of repair to do and give him some privacy. But this experience had made him realise what was important to him, and he asked Virginie to marry him. She came straight back and said, well, I'll marry you if Pete's the best man. So it's a funny thing, life, isn't it? And do a single-handed world round the world race, come back with the best friend, and Tracy and Virginie get on well, the kids get on well, and we had this amazing French wedding. It was
unusual that often, and we've interviewed quite a few people who've, you know, been rescued with their rescuers, and often there's a slight weirdness in that relationship, yeah, so an imbalance in a way.
Yeah, and I hadn't realised that. It was just perfectly natural. It felt perfectly natural. Raph would have done it for me, and that was just fate had thrown it that way. And I think partly having those 10 days together, nursing him and getting to know him. But it wasn't until I met the pilot and the navigator at the Guinness stand a year later that they'd explained that often a relationship like built on something like that is bogged down with debts of honour and guilt and all of this baggage. But there's never been any of that whatsoever. And I suspect that's probably the case with most Vendée sailors. You know, your safety net is each other. And it's just life at sea, you know, that these disasters happen and you're there for each other, which is...
That's such a lovely story. What happened when you arrived into Hobart? I mean, did you have any sense at all that the world had been watching this rescue unfold?
No, not really, because I'd had a knockdown another blow before Raph's, and I lost my radio, which was the main communications back then through Portishead, and I mean, comms now are incredible, and. Because I then had damage to the generator and my power, and I had my laptop had some water ingress, and it was all a bit iffy. So I was only getting tiny bits of information, it was a bit of a shock. It was quite funny because I went into the Derwent at night, and I didn't have charts, And I knew it was dodgy because I'd gone in on the British Steel Challenge and was just gently nursing my way in. And eventually this, you know, official launch turned up with a blue light and a doctor, a surgeon, hospital bed, a policeman, an immigration officer, and handed him over and was, I've got a certificate for a Frenchman from the Australian government. But in the race rules, he was taken to hospital and I was taken out onto a buoy. And provided nobody gets on the boat and you don't get off, they'll still treat this as an unassisted circumnavigation. And that was a funny, difficult period on the boat because the press didn't really affect me. Some came out, but I was just away on my boat. Raph was getting the attention, which was fine for me. Because I had my own wrestles then. I was very tired, didn't know whether the structural integrity of the boat had been compromised. We'd then had a 5-week period in the race where every week we lost a boat. And very sadly, Jerry Roofs, who was a friend, he lost his life. And it was a particularly bad race weather-wise. And so they were forecast 2 days out was another severe storm. And by then everyone had gone, so if there was any problem, there wouldn't be any help. So it was pretty lonely, really, to be honest. It was first time I felt lonely. Up till then, I'd missed people. So had a cup of tea and went back to 10 years ago, that first two-handed race, and went through in my mind all the hurdles to get to Hobart. And then it's a pretty simple choice. Sometimes you either sit down and give up or you get on with it. I couldn't afford to ship the boat home. I had to get, you know, all these considerations. And I was going to finish the Vendée. It was just, But it was tough. It was tough going down then because my arm was really bad. I couldn't get help, but a doctor came out and looked at it from a dinghy, and there wasn't really much he could do. So a quite heavy heart, actually, that went back out, and 2 days later was in that storm and put me back on the bike and just got on with it, really. And so for me, you know, the rescue was obviously a massive thing, but it was only part of, I was only halfway around the world, you know. I mean, I had to do an operation on my elbow and all these issues to get to the finish. So it wasn't, it was big, but it had its place within the whole for me, if that makes sense. And it was another thing I'd had to deal with, and that was behind and was looking forward. So the finish, that was where the real publicity was mad, absolutely mad. But I'm getting on with my job, you know. Managed to save Raphael, I had a race to do. I mean, the race was finished, but to me, it was finishing it was the key.
We're going to leave Pete there for now. After all that drama in the Southern Ocean, he slipped out of the Derwent River and headed east. Tasmania astern, the entire Pacific Ocean ahead of him. Just imagine. For the more squeamish listener, the next edition quickly gets into Pete's account of performing an operation on his own elbow, which is pretty grim. But we also talk about Pete's other massive project. In fact, before you listen to part two, grab your phone and do a quick image search for Team Phillips. It would be good to have an idea of exactly what Pete talks about when we get going on his next big adventure. Also, a quick note too of Raphael Donnelly. Good to their promise, Pete and Raphael had within a year raced together, winning their class in the 1997 Transat-Jacques Vabre. And following the proposal faxed from the Southern Ocean, Pete was also best man at Raphael's wedding. Even more remarkably, Raphael's adventures did nothing to dampen his Vendée spirit. He was on the start line for the 2000 edition, but failed to finish. He then raced again in 2004 and in 2008. He finished both a 12th place and then a top 10. Remarkably, in both editions, he crossed the line after 125 days at sea, just 2 hours splitting his two times. If you've enjoyed the podcast and you'd like to show your support, then please do head over to buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast. We work hard to bring you this quality ad-free listen. It takes time and a lot of work, so it's lovely to have your support and also your messages. So many, many thanks for that. And thanks, as ever, to the tireless work of the multi-talented Tim at Vertigo Films, producer of the podcast, who selflessly put in the miles with me on the trip west to see Pete. Tim, as ever, a massive thank you. And so that's it from us. Do tune into part two with Pete. And until next time, thank you so much for listening. Have fun on the water and sail safe, everyone.
This is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Lakeside is on boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
A bit lower and faster here.
Ho, ho, ho. That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the line on there.
We're looking at 10.5 and 42.
Matching him on the boundary, yeah.
Copy.
This is Castle One standing by. Out.